This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Tonight on Lefty Pinkos, we discuss the impact of SBS Struggle Street documentary series about Mount Druitt residents and their lives in what is considered to be a low-income area of Sydney. The controversy this has caused has been colossal, with Blacktown Mayor Stephen Barley leading a protest on the day of the broadcast after the trailer released that seemed to demean the participants of the documentary series. The participants have also called out their representation in the program, including Peter Kennedy, who appears alongside her husband and children, accusing the show of portraying her as a bogan no-hoper.
So tonight, what we're going to be doing, we're going to be speaking with former guest and a wonderful Joy regular, Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, who was on the phone. She recently wrote a piece for The Drum, Struggle Street. What's Tacky is telling Western Sydneysiders how helpless they are. Now, Dr. Lauren Rosewarne will go through is a senior lecturer in the School of Social and Political Sciences and a regular contributor to The Drum, Hoopla, and author of six books, including the most recent, Masturbation in Pop Culture, Sex, Society, and Self. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lauren Rosewarne. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on board. It's an absolute pleasure to have you back on Joy and back on Lefty Pinkos.
Thank you.
Now, I want to ask, because the way I've described this is it Struggle Street, poverty porn or powerful programming? Now, what's your take on this term? Because it has been used a lot in describing Struggle Street is being called poverty porn.
Yeah, this word, this term poverty porn, I mean, you're seeing porn attached to anything, food porn, real estate porn, etc. It's an inflammatory term that's supposed to reflect that there's something salacious about our consumption of a certain media item. Now, whether that applies to Struggle Street, I actually think it's tricky. My article was written based on the promos and the lead-up, which I felt were very tabloid in style. The actual show itself, I think, was far less tabloidy and far less, if you like, shock value. It was more serious than the marketing material portrayed. I actually don't think it was as much poverty porn as the marketing material made it out to be. That said, it does raise the question of whether watching people who are society's marginalised or outliers is somehow gratuitous, is somehow pornographic if we're watching it for entertainment value. It certainly does raise that question.
You, in the article, and you have said that this was based on the trailer, so we won't go too much into, you know, obviously the details of this in comparison, but you have talked about, you know, marginalised groups are not a new concept for people to make documentary series about and reality series about, especially the LGBTIQ community. For a long time, it was kind of fetishised in these documentary series, and now we're seeing a completely different turnaround in Australia, because before this, you know, in Australia, there wasn't that much, especially in recent years, where they discussed people who were in lower income brackets.
Absolutely. Australia's history of reality TV has largely, not exclusively, but largely been around the lives of the rich, the famous, the vacuous.
Real Housewives of Melbourne, wink.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas the UK and the US have a much longer history of reality TV shows built around what I, as I said, I use the term marginalised. So yeah, LGBTI community, absolutely. But also poor people such as Here's Honey Boo Boo, which ran for 3 years in the United States, as well as fat people. And certainly Australia has made a version of Biggest Loser. But there's a slew of these programs that are focusing on people who are largely or have largely been underrepresented in mainstream popular culture. The question it raises is any representation good? But also whether is this in fact a harking back to pre-television era when it was freak show entertainment, that we're actually watching people we consider so very different to ourselves and therefore are watching it not that we're interested in their lives so much as we want something to look at and laugh at.
Lauren, one of the thoughts I had when I was seeing some of the reaction to the show was, does it feed into a whole lot of prejudices that people have, more well-off people have, about people who are poor? Because I think people imagine, you know, if you lost your job or you lost your house, you know, you'd struggle by. And then you see the reality of it, and they then starts to feed their prejudice and their bias against these sorts of people who are really at the bottom end of our society.
Absolutely, and I think you raise an excellent question about this idea of fairness and representation of people who are actually really suffering. And I think to the Indigenous character William, who has a really difficult burden on his shoulders by appearing in this show, because he's a person who represents, like it or not, the Indigenous community, who is severely underrepresented in Australian film and television. So the fact that he's A, poor, and B, a substance abuser on this program raises questions about what does that do to the already problematic impression Australians have of Indigenous people in Australia. And I think it has it's dangerous, and I think it potentially can make people think worse of the community. That said, I don't know. I mean, he was probably one of the more interesting characters, so I don't want to presume on the part of other people that they can't look at it critically. I certainly am surprised that a lot of the feedback after the show was actually relatively positive, if not concerned that the system has let these people down, something that didn't come up in the show, but I think it's certainly a subtle undercurrent. Is we've got multi-generational poverty in this community that we don't like talking about in Australia, because, again, that has to then acknowledge what have we done to these communities where we've allowed that to happen for a number of generations, where multiple generations are on welfare.
It was interesting to me that one of the show's defenders was actually our social services minister, Scott Morrison, who said it was very important. And for me, it seems like, yes, mate, here's your problem, now address. Like,
yeah.
And yet it was kind of like, oh, I'll defend it, SBS, yes, and walks away.
Yeah, really interesting, because if you are going to say it's valuable, you have to then determine, well, what's it valuable for? Is it valuable just because it's an anthropological lesson on people who are different than us? Or, in fact, does it highlight some social problems in Australia that need addressing? I think it's the latter. Therefore, that really does acknowledge that the government has a role here, that rather than ever be looking for ways to cut benefits, in fact, what more can be done in these communities to change that cycle of poverty?
I did say we weren't going to talk too much about it, but obviously the lead up tonight with the budget concerning, and a lot of the leader has been dealing with fairness. But for me, if you link it in with this show Struggle Street, which is representing people who don't seem to be getting a fair go in our society, it's, and none of the talk about it is looking at lower income families. It's always been about people who have super, have all these I suppose it's some like fallbacks in them. And I mean, one of the main characters was a fallback because he had an accident on his job and then couldn't provide. And it's really quite interesting to see that, you know, that the government is saying, yes, of course, you know, this is really important. Well, Scott Morrison representing the government, and then now we're going to head up to this budget, which has talked all about a fair go for maybe people who are just above, but who are just above if you look at a class system, especially.
Yeah, but I think if you have a look at election cycles in Australia for the past 20 years, the idea of focusing on the very poorest of people has never been on the agenda for any government.
That is true.
And that's because they're not a seductive group in terms of a voting bloc. Both parties would much rather focus on what they love to call the working family, the idea of the battlers. The battlers in that definition are never at the poorest end of the spectrum, because the poorest of the poor are often considered what's termed in public policy talk a wicked problem. And by that we mean really that there will always be poverty, that kind of poverty can never really be eliminated. So governments or political parties are far better off trying to court the middle voters, the people who are potentially swinging voters, and the people who actually have genuine stakes in issues like superannuation and GST, as opposed to that voting bloc which is at the other end of the really poor spectrum.
This just makes me believe even more so that politics, that some people have a complete lack of compassion. You are here on Lefty Pinkos with Emma and Patrick. We are joined via the phone, Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, speaking about the impact of the documentary series Struggle Street on SBS. Thanks again for joining us, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
Now, obviously, the critique was mainly from the trailer, was the tabloidy trailer, as you've described it. And then the reaction has been to the actual show quite a... a sort of a mixture of positive but concerned as well. But the response from the actual participants has been very negative.
Yeah, and this is something I anticipated would be the case, and certainly a point that I made in my ABC article was the fact that at the university, let's say I want to do a research project with human participants, they need to sign off, basically sign a document that acknowledges that they know their rights and that they know any potential risks that may occur. That same burden doesn't plague documentary filmmakers. It does, however, raise the concern as to whether any of this type of ethics clearance or risk assessment was actually done. Because I know at the university, if I was to do research with population groups that are considered vulnerable, and that would be poor people, substance abusers, the mentally ill, it would be really difficult to get their consent to participate in a research project because it would consider to be that there's a whole lot of risks in them participating. Were these risks known to the participants who agreed to go into that documentary series? Because it's really easy to say, oh, but they were paid, they were compensated. In fact, did they really know what they were signing on to? And I think this is a really tricky thing to determine. Certainly one of the participants, Peter, said that she was unfairly represented. I think this question of fair representation is a really interesting one too.
The other response has been obviously from the publicity that this show has given these families, especially for Peter's daughter who lives with Asperger's. And apparently the response, you know, as anyone who is in the public eye, there's going to be a negative response no matter how wonderful you are or if you're anybody. And the response has been very kind of getting a lot of cyberbullying as well. And so it makes me really think that they did not realize the maybe weren't aware of how this would impact their lives and weren't outlined it in the initial agreement.
And this is, I think, a combination of two things. On one hand, I'd like to know whether the producers actually did a risk assessment, because to me it doesn't seem at all surprising that participants in a reality TV show would get, and particularly one about poverty, would get some level of backlash. I mean, it happens to My Kitchen Rules contestants
who are basically
a larky, let alone what it's happening to people who are already demonised in our culture, particularly young people. And I think certainly if you're trying to get young people to participate in a research project, again, that is really tricky. So we need to know how well informed were the families versus was the lure of money enough for them to overlook what's potentially a really narrow or short-sighted decision when they decided to sign up.
The issue, I think the difference too is someone in My Kitchen Rules or one of these building things or one of these, even The Biggest Loser, although that one I think strays closer to this SBS show than the others, is that by now everybody who signs up for those shows has to be aware. But this show that we're talking about was going into their lives. This is their everyday. This isn't something put on for entertainment.
Yeah, and I think, look, this is tricky because I think pretty much most people who have had access to a television at any time in the past 20 years would know that reality television is a very specific genre that has the habit of distorting our lives and distorting our personalities through clever editing and strategic use of music. That said, I looking at the show now, I wonder whether it was actually sold to these participants as a reality TV show, or in fact, as my hunch is, it was actually sold to them as a documentary, because the marketing material made it look reality TV style, but the actual format of the show was more akin to a documentary, which makes me think that the participants probably had a different expectation as to how they would appear rather than the kind of hybrid we have in front of us, which really focuses a lot on the negatives.
I wonder if the producers knew what they were signing these people up for.
Yeah, a really good question, because again, they don't have the same burden that an academic would in terms of really analysing a situation and determining what the potential risks are. Certainly, I really have, and certainly this was evident in the trailer, you had a man walking down the street who looked thoroughly disoriented. I'd like to know how he could consent to a program like that where he seemed really, really detached from his surroundings. How do they get his signature on a form? It's perplexing to me, let alone under 18.
Exactly, and it's one of these things that keeps cropping up in my mind, and it was a word that uses kind of exploitation, but you don't know who's exploiting who out of this scenario.
Absolutely. We don't have, the books aren't open in front of us for us to know how much these people were paid. That said, it raises the issue, which I think we, you know, certainly it's a topic I've discussed on Joy before, is this question of consent. And can people sign their own rights away? Because just because you've signed an agreement to say you agree to be on a television show, how can you agree if you don't really know what's going to happen? Because as Emma mentioned, yeah, you could say, for example, that My Kitchen Rules or those type of television shows follow a very similar format that has taken place year after year after year. Struggle Street was a completely unknown quantity. So participants may have agreed because the financial incentive was great, but agreeing to something under the guise of a documentary doesn't necessarily agree in terms of you consenting to everything about the program. And it also raises some ethical considerations. If, for example, we paid as taxpayers all of the participants in the show, in episode one we have a character who spent money on crystal meth. Does that mean you and I, as taxpayers, funded that? It raises a lot of ethical issues.
I think, yeah, the public funding has been also a huge, huge debate on this, especially because of the scene where they're talking about crystal meth. And certainly it does have, but at the same time, this show did have and still and seems to show a lot of people the potential to be a very important insight into people's life, into people who have been forgotten by the system.
Unquestionably. And look, truth be told, I think there's a constant debate that we want to have about whether the taxpayer should fund this. Well, look, I don't watch sport on television, and yet in this country, we heavily support, we heavily fund sport. So we don't get as a population, and I think this is a good thing, we don't have a referendum for every dollar that the government spends. We have public broadcasters because they are looking at issues, looking at problems, looking at ethnic minorities, looking at social minorities, who have traditionally been completely neglected from mainstream media. That may not please everyone, just as spending money on the opera or spending money on art or sport doesn't please everybody. That's not the point. We find that's the very role of the government, is to step in when the private sector won't.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight. That is Dr. Lauren Rose-Warne.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.